It is almost 7 p.m., which means it's almost time for Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg here on WBAI New York 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Nash, we're building bridges, not walls.
Later in the program, truth be told, how asylum seekers and new immigrants, while suffering the outrageous, racist, and xenophobic slings and arrows for the ambitions of political opportunists, actually boost the economy and enhance democracy.
First, apartheid and Zionism, the unspoken alliance. Now, a labor perspective on the histadrut and the task of solidarity with David Hemson. David Hemson is a socialist, an organizer, a researcher, and a social historian. He was a student leader in apartheid South Africa and founded the Student Wages Commissions in 1971 and actively participated at the Durban mass strikes in 1973 before being declared a communist and being arrested. He organized as casual workers and initiated the National Dock Labor Scheme.
David was appointed a research director with the Human Science Research Council, focusing his research on access to water and improving service delivery and resolving inequality. He writes on racial capitalism and labor history and continues to support workers' movement internationally. And David, welcome. And I want to start from what normally would be the end, but I don't want to run out of time, and then we'll work our way back. And what I mean is, David, while there has been some pushback from organized labor to the Israeli pseudo-labor organization, the Histadrut, and the genocide of the Israeli Zionist-driven state against Gaza, and with us expecting Netanyahu's promised ground invasion of Rafah, what must we do as labor to stand with the Palestinian people and confront our union leaders to stop supporting Zionist Israel? And thank you for the years and decades of work fighting apartheid and still fighting apartheid, this time in Israel.
Mimi, look, thanks for that introduction. And I'm so pleased to be in discussion with you and with the listeners. Yes, how do we take up the question of solidarity? My mind is cast back to the struggle against apartheid, because in a way, I think we have some similarities. In South Africa, we had a cheap labor system of extreme exploitation of black workers, which had massive profits for those Anglo-American capitalists who invested in the mining industry and elsewhere and had a massive return. And when we stood up as workers, the black working class stood up and announced itself that it was becoming organized and militant, then we found that the AFL-CIO and other international trade unions took interest in us, unfortunately not giving solidarity, but actually siding in against us with the bosses and with the apartheid regime. It's a terrible history, which I'm only learning now in part because it was hard to believe. In other words, we have all the strength in labor. We've got a rising labor movement in the United States. We've got mass organization among youth at the universities and in the unions, you know, against this genocide, which is being practiced in Palestine by the Israeli army. And yet, you know, we don't really see that pressure forcing the different governments to stand back, to repudiate what is taking place in Palestine. And to stand in solidarity with all those who do not want to see on every night pictures of bodies, of children being killed, unbelievable misery which is being dealt with on the Palestinian people.
Well, we're going to get back to this because there are things that can specifically be done, and I know you're going to help us relate some of that. But I want to get back to, let's begin with UN Resolution 3379 in 1975 that identifies Zionism as a form of racism, and then enlighten us as to the relationship of the Israeli state to South Africa during that period and the height of apartheid oppression of the indigenous people of South Africa, so we can begin to learn the true history of Israel, Israeli Zionism, and its histadrut, which we'll talk more about, certainly you will, as it relates to the suppression and subversion of labor and class unity.
Yes. Maybe, you know, when we talk about, you know, Zionism being a form of racism, sometimes people raise their eyebrows and say, well, look, you know, how is that? But if you examine the ideology, of course, there's the exclusive ownership and stake in the land and the exploitation or the complete extradition of people who are living there in the first place, which is what you know has happened in South Africa and in Israel. And oddly enough, it wasn't the United Nations or even the Palestinian people which initially made that comparison. It was made by none other than Dr. Hendrik Verwoerd in 1969, who had visited Israel and made the observation that what Israel was doing was correct and it was a form of apartheid. So from the mouth of the very ideologist of apartheid, you know, the identity was made. And as you mentioned, later, as we had the struggles in South Africa developed and in Palestine too, you know, there was this United Nations resolution which put it together. But that's just one part of it, because that's, in a sense, you know, the role of propaganda ideas out there, and that similarity is established and now quite well entrenched in people's understanding of what's happening in Israel. But there was something else, which was an unspoken, because they didn't really want it to be public, but an alliance, you know, between the Israeli state and the apartheid state. And I know that because as a white youth, I was forced into the army or into prison at that time. At that time, it wasn't an act of war when I was in the army. And we, you know, one of the places that I was sent to was towards the South African border in Mozambique. And there was a rocket site. And then I learned from the people around that was a testing site for Israel and for South Africa to try out rockets in a very quiet backwater of South Africa's natural habitat, one of our game reserves, and they used that to test out different military equipment. So by the time we had the development of guerrilla struggle in South Africa, we found that Israel was on the opposite side. It was supporting every split and division that there was at that time in the movements that fought against apartheid in Namibia and in South Africa. And that was all, of course, with the connivance of the CIA. It was all structured in that way, and of course, an intimate relationship with the South African army. And they built up an arms industry, in a sense, which was second to none. Remember that even though Reagan and the others fought against arms embargo, it was forced on them. So Israel and South Africa came together because they found that they didn't have that easy access to arms. And more than that, there was actually collaboration on a nuclear front. So South Africa provided uranium, the yellow cake uranium, to Israel. And in turn, Israel provided all the secrets, the design and so forth, for a nuclear bomb in South Africa. And on the 22nd of September 1979, there was an explosion offshore. I was at that time lecturing at the University of Dar es Salaam, and there was a tremor felt, throughout the university and throughout the city, because they now knew that the apartheid regime was a nuclear power, and that it wouldn't hesitate to use that power if they had to, and it was a reserve power that they could use at any time. So that was the way in which the Israeli state and the apartheid state collaborated, and even today it's not fully written up. Although there's some useful information, it's not fully described, and I myself am a little astonished when I go into the detail and see just the extent to which, it developed. Israel supported the arms regime in South Africa. South Africa gave its technology to Israel. When I made a visit to Israel in 1989, I saw their evidence, South African SABS, that's the South African Bureau of Standards, on much of the solar heating systems on the roofs and so forth, and that was part of the exchange. There was that solar heating system exchanged for rockets, a kind of trade between two pariah nations at that time, which developed a powerful force against the forces of liberation at that time. Of course, it's now we see South Africa is defeated, the apartheid regime was defeated, and now we have a complete turnaround with South Africa going to the international courts to describe what's taking place in Palestine right now as genocide, and that's something obviously we all support. But what is the labor movement to do rather than to watch and hope to have actions from an international court? We hope to see that, but at the same time, we know that much more is needed, and maybe we could go into that. Mm-hmm.
David, how does the pseudo-labor federation of the Histadrut provide cover for Israel?
Well, it's a really interesting point. You see, I was used to be in a union or a set of unions we had. Of course, I was declared a communist and ended up in exile. But we did get some support from the ICFTU, that is International Confederation of Free Trade Unions, so-called. We were skeptical of them, but at least we were, it was one point of contact we had with the Swedish, the British, the European trade union movement. And when I went there, of course, I found that they were very half-hearted. They weren't too keen on giving us support. They wanted to know, why was I declared a communist and am I a communist? And all, it was a kind of, that kind of atmosphere. But the Histadrut really had enormous influence in the ICFTU. It was regarded as one of the powerful unions of the ICFTU and of other international trade secretariat. I used to organize the textile workers as well as the dock workers in Durban, and we used to participate in an international textile and leather and garment workers union at that time. And the Histadrut was very influential in that, making sure that there'd be no criticism of its actions and its enormous investment in companies, which were then developing like the Zim shipping line and other developments, which we were beginning to learn as South Africans, were building up the arms industry in South Africa, to which those who were forced to be in the army were actually then finding that was in their hands, and then they were expected to use it against the black majority. So the Histadrut, although it had that face, the public face, a false face, of being a trade union, was actually a core investment unit, and oddly enough, also the biggest employer in Israel. So it's the claim to be a union is somewhat pretentious. And we found it was very actively organizing in support of the regime, the very regime which we were resisting.
And also the Histadrut, and if you could get into maybe some more specifics about the role of Israel, the role of the Histadrut at that time that you were organizing those labor unions. And I know that you were involved in one of the most famous and important strikes in the history of contemporary labor relations, and that were the Durban strikes of the dock workers. But I'm also interested in how the ICFTU and its role and all the in as a subordinate component of the AFL-CIO, where that ties in, because they played a rather infamous and insidious role in conjunction with groups like the Histadrut, which they still contribute to mightily in support.
Yes, thanks for that, Mary. Well, of course, the 1973 mass strikes were really a huge epochal change, in South Africa, where we had not just a few thousand, not just tens of thousands, but almost 100,000 workers coming on strike every day, another factory coming out. Every day when we would go to down the streets, you'd see workers marching with sticks, demonstrating. And the police with their submachine guns and all the armaments, in a sense, paralyzed, because at that time it was not, they thought it was not wise to shoot into the crowd and maybe to turn those strikes into an insurrection and into a huge conflagration. I was a white person, the workers would grab us, that is to say those who among us who are white in the trade union movement. We would open up the halls and have mass meetings of workers. And within weeks, we had the formation of trade unions open to all workers and with a black majority. And that really put the scare into the apartheid regime. We started breaking up the cheap labor system, getting the workers the right to live in the urban areas, because remember, a black person had no right to live in the urban areas. Was unbelievable forms of repression. And we were looking for allies. We wanted, we imagined that the whole world would open up and stand in solidarity, but that's not what we found from the AFL-CIO and even from the British TUC, which, the word would be tended to support the British employers, actually did support the British and the American employers and said, well, we have to have reforms. We don't want to have decisive change. So the unions we formed were democratic, mass meetings. We had regular meetings. It was we had hand collections of money because we weren't allowed to do a checkoff system. And it was, it was a complete new mood in South Africa. But in the 1980s, we found that the AFL-CIO was beginning to intervene in the South African movement as it developed in a more radical way. And in 1982, to the surprise of us all, I still can't believe it happened, but the AFL-CIO gave the Meany Award for Human Rights to one Chief Gacho Buthelezi, who was a leader of one of the Bantustans, who had nothing to do with the labor movement, in fact was opposing the labor movement, was opposing strikes and sending scabs and so forth to break up the strikes. Not that he succeeded, but he did succeed in killing a lot of our youth and of our trade union organizers. So the AFL-CIO, unfortunately, gave full support to Buthelezi and declared that he was one of the great nationalist leaders of South Africa. In 1986, Chief Buthelezi launched a Zulu union. In fact, it was a killing organization. It was called USA, United Workers Union of South Africa, with businessmen as its leaders. And then we later found out that many of those leaders, or the rank and file, or the so-called cadres of that movement, had actually been trained in Namibia then, but trained by the South African army as killing squads, death squads, and turned out to break up strikes like the famous strike we had outside Pietermaritzburg, in a rubber factory, which went on for weeks and then for months and attracted international support. They sent in squads there, goon squads, to go and break up and kill one, especially the women shop stewards and so forth, and create devastation among our ranks. And we knew where it was coming from. We knew what, you know, where the support from that Gacho Buthelezi and his pseudo union was coming from, and we were fighting against it. The Histadrut, though, I now found, was involved in that, because they did some of the training of the so-called informal the anti-working class death squads, which were set up by the South African army and the intelligence to try and divide the black majority and to create havoc within the trade unions. So there is that link. When we would go to international trade unions in the 1970s, we would find that the Histadrut was present there, and giving out the propaganda in favor of Israel. Later on, it actually took South African leaders who were claiming to be trade unionists and trained them at the Afro-Asian Labor Center, which was a kind of a junior partner to the AFL-CIO. None of us in South Africa were confused about that. We saw this as enemy, and eventually that broke down. So everything they did in the future then became secretive, sub rosa, deaths at night when no one would know. Those people who were doing that, dishing out the perverse response to a labor movement and killing our comrades, you know, those people were trained by the CIA, by the movement that they called the WUSA, and I understand now the Histadrut was involved in that as well. So, that's a terrible history, which we are now trying to open up and discuss. Mm.
David, and how has the Histadrut had a decisive role in the international labor movement, particularly in countering any criticism of Zionism and opposing boycotts of Israeli shipping?
Well, you know, in Durban, we have quite a militant group of dock workers. I'm proud to say that I was involved in organizing in the 1970s and again in the 1990s. And as I was introduced, you know, helped to set up a national dock labor scheme that's had another history now. But at least we fought and tried to be able to build a real change for labor, as we ended the apartheid regime. Now we found in the 1980s and 90s, there was this company, Zim Shipping, and in a famous case, Zim Shipping was told, the Durban dockers learned that the Zim Shipping was bringing arms, which was going to be provided through South Africa to the Zimbabwean regime. I think eventually those arms are actually from China, but they were being transported by Zim Shipping. The Durban doctors refused to handle the ship, It was sent away. There was international solidarity, and I'm very proud to say that I've met some of those workers who were involved in that and made a stand against the repression of workers in Zimbabwe and elsewhere, and against this Zionist shipping company which was oppressing the workers in Palestine.
Well, we would be remiss if we didn't go into some summation and understanding of how the AFL-CIO, who is still great friends with Histadrut, really collaborated with the South African apartheid regime to support death squads masquerading as a trade union. If you could talk somewhat about that and then take us into how you understand the role of the Histadrut now in terms of its response to Palestinian workers, splitting the working class, if you will, in the historic land known as Palestine, otherwise supporting the occupation and the like.
Well, Mimi, the point about history in South Africa was really that it gave comfort to the enemy and stood against us in opposing the enemy of apartheid. In the textile union for which I was, active only I think for about 12 months before I got house arrest, but we would interact at the international level. We were fighting to be able to get strike funds so that we would get concrete support when thousands of our workers were being fired. We campaigned to get them rehired. And we needed money. We needed money to bail our workers out. We needed money to be able to get lawyers to defend our workers and so forth. By the way, we attracted, quite considerable support at times. And one of the famous strikes that we had in a place called Pinetown, which was one of the biggest blanket manufacturers in the world at that time, we managed to get support. Financial support from one of the unions, a Japanese textile union, and that was enormous. It changed everything because we could have lost a major strike, and in fact, we didn't win it outright, but at least we got a compromise. We didn't lose it. And that was what we were looking for. But when we would approach the International Textile and Leather and Garment Union, we would find the Histadrut was very opposed, ambiguous, never giving outright support to the workers. And I understand even as recently as 2010, which of course is a long time back from where I'm discussing, the Histadrut said that they had managed to stop any international resistance to Israeli rule in Palestine by taking resolutions by international trade unions. Now, they claimed that as a massive victory, and in a sense, that's actually what they were doing. They were, as I mentioned, Histadrut was the major employer. It was part and parcel of the Israeli state. And it actually wanted to defeat any opposition or any change in that was taking place in Israel at that time. And that all had repercussions for us in South Africa because, we're relatively isolated. We're not so off the map in a sense now, particularly South Africa's, well known for making a stand against Zionist oppression. But at that time, we really needed friends, and we were getting thumbs down, from them. And then we understand that now because I understand that the Histadrut then didn't allow non-Israeli workers to be part of their membership. They didn't extend benefits to workers. In a sense, it wasn't a real trade union. It was actually, a Zionist organization. In other words, only available to Jewish workers. That apparently has changed now in the Constitution. And I understand that to some extent, Histadrut has retreated from owning, many of the companies as privatization has taken place. And I think they've supported that. What they've done with that money, we don't know. But certainly they're not using that to open the opportunities for for the Palestinian workers within Israel, and to fight for the rights of workers who are forced as Palestinian workers to under horrendous conditions to work in construction and elsewhere, whose we don't really hear very much about. And now the Israeli state has actually refused them the right to enter over the frontiers that they've set up. So, all of this is nothing to be proud of. In fact, it's a great shame. And there's no reason why the AFL-CIO should give support. In fact, we must fight to break those links. We want to see an active campaign linking up workers in America from point to point and internationally so that Labour stands united against forms of racism and oppression and of genocide, as we are seeing now.
Mm-hmm. Well, you certainly set the example. We've been speaking with David Hempson, socialist organizer, researcher, author, and social historian. He was a student leader in apartheid South Africa and continues to do what? Educate, agitate, and organize for social justice, because a new world is possible, and we are the ones with the kind of tools that David provides us to make it so. And for all of us involved in the community sector who are in workplaces, who are in unions or worker associations, what do we need to do? Well, we need to certainly have resolutions for a ceasefire now, support self-determination, and most decidedly, what do we need to do? Boycott, sanction, and divest organizations from organizations like the AFL-CIO, organizations like mine, which is the UAW, which had formerly supported to the tunes of hundreds of thousands of dollars, organizations like the Histadrut. We've got to make sure that workers demand divestiture, ceasefire now, self-determination for our Palestinian sibling workers and workers of the world unite. David Hempson, we'll have you back. We'll continue to talk about these things. Thank you for your decades of really perilous but intrepid organizing for the working class.
Amadla, Mimi.
Amadla, indeed. Awetu.
Isaiah 2:4 says, "And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore."
Ayanna Gregory, cease fire now. Cease fire now.
Anthony Copete is a senior data and policy analyst at the Immigration Research Initiative and partners with David Desigret-Kallick, director of the Immigration Research Initiative. Both have done extensive research and writing on the economic and fiscal aspects of immigration as a national, state, and metro area, and the local area.
Well, Anthony Capote and David Disregard Kallik. David, it's great to have you back. And I want to begin by putting things in a political context. I mean, historically, immigrants and immigrants of color most definitively are negated and denigrated and used as kind of cannon fodder opportunistically for the political ambitions of both Republican and Democratic candidates for office. From the first moment in the political cycle, if you will, of Trump and his descent in Trump Tower down the golden escalator, he already, as he announced his candidacy, couldn't wait a moment but to denigrate and defame Mexican asylum seekers. How do both of you understand the phenomena of scapegoating asylum seekers, new immigrants, and why the public buys into the propaganda so readily? I mean, how do you understand that? And then, of course, we'll talk about this marvelous new report that shows the opposite, which is the contributions of asylum seekers, new immigrants, to democracy and the economy. Owen, thank you for joining us.
Yeah. Well, thanks, Mimi, and thanks for having us, of course. I mean, I don't know. It's, of course, very disturbing to see the way that politics has developed in America around immigration. I mean, my family came in the days of Ellis Island when immigrants remade New York and the country, and there were lots of immigrants after World War II. That's when the asylum system was put in place. Anthony's family came here from Cuba at a time when a lot of immigrants came to Florida in a short period. I mean, those were all cases where there were challenges when people first arrived. It wasn't easy, and people weren't necessarily welcomed at first. But in pretty short order, families started building a life in this country and were part of the story of the growth of the country. So I really have a hard time identifying with and understanding this idea that we should be pitting newcomers against people who have been here a long time.
And Anthony, your thoughts?
Well, you know, I think it is in many ways emblematic of how a lot of people feel. I think many people in the United States are aware that the system is unfair. They are aware that somehow they're not getting a fair shake. And we've built a narrative system that routinely places blame downward. And you can't really get further down in our social system than newly arrived immigrants who are struggling to build a brand new life for themselves and their families. And so our system is built to generate animosity toward them and not toward the folks who are causing the inefficiency or the inequality in the first place.
David, talk about the most recent of the Institute for Immigrant Initiative showing that we can accept asylum seekers and newly arriving immigrants to become a part of the economy quickly, to become an even bigger part of it over time. And how is it possible, given the hurdles they face socially and politically? And Anthony, perhaps you could break that down for us based upon particular localities you've studied.
Sure, I'm glad to say. I mean, we don't have data yet to show how people are doing who are arriving today. But what we can do is look at how people with similar characteristics have done in the recent past. And so what we can model, as we model it out, is that when people first arrive, they're likely to make $22,000 a year in the median. So that's not a great wage, but it's enough to get out of a shelter. It's enough to start to settle your family. It helps if there are two wage earners, as there often are. And that's the beginning place for them. You know, we see that after 5 years, that rises from 22,000 to about 32,000. So getting to be pretty decent. If you have two wage earners, so 64,000 together for a family. And many, many of the people who are coming today are families, which is a little different than what we've seen in the past, because people are fleeing with their families from violence and disruptions in the countries they're coming from.
Well, you know, I'm real interested in how this begins to break down. I would say that while I am just profoundly troubled historically, as I indicated with the opening, the political opportunism, the scapegoatism that politicians in particular employ against new immigrants, against asylum seekers, which has become a major feature in the previous election and now the current election. And here we have these incredibly hardworking people driven to this country by the very circumstances of imperialist ruination on their own countries, climate disaster and the like. So help us understand how they do get a foothold. And also, I do this because I am so troubled that the narrative has rooted itself in the public. So that I represent very, very poor people who are themselves immigrants. And oftentimes their response are, well, I may be getting in trouble paying my rent no matter how hard I work because the rents are too damn high. How come I'm not getting a handout? But they are, and they are robbing our treasuries. But that's exactly the opposite of what is sought by new immigrants. And so, and it's exactly the opposite of what your report seems to be showing. So, David, I don't know if you and or Anthony or both of you want to field that question. And again, we are talking to two mighty researchers from the Immigration Research Initiative. Oh, who wants to start us on that?
I can say a little, and then Anthony, why don't you take over? But I just say so. Mimi, I think you, when you say you represent, you represent them as a lawyer, right?
Yes, through the Legal Aid Society, the indigent and very, very poor immigrant populations.
Yeah, and it's hard. And I mean, I feel like, you know, it's we don't do well with any of the people who are already here, who are in helping to make sure people can be on their feet. And, you know, a lot of the pressure we see in big cities, especially right now, is in homeless shelters, which are just in incredible stress because of stuff that we have done over the decades, right? It's not because of the immigrants who are coming today. It's because we haven't invested in affordable housing and in helping people to be able to take care of themselves. And so you can certainly understand why people would feel bad. It's just tragic to see that turned around against people who are in similar circumstances, rather than seeing that, you know, as I think your program shows over and over, it's by banding together that we're going to ever change that and make it better for everybody. So I don't know, Anthony, let me...
Yeah, I strongly agree with that, of course. I think a lot of the challenges that we face in New York in particular with managing new immigrant arrivals is a lot of these are really sort of microcosms of bigger issues that the city has faced and sort of sidestepped or swept under the rug for decades at this point. And part of the work that we've been doing in this area is really trying to focus on coming up with solutions that are going to help immigrants now, but can also help millions of New Yorkers for decades to come. excuse me. And what's really important to bear in mind here is, you know, as you mentioned, Mimi, immigrants are not coming to sort of drain the social support system. And that's really not what immigrants wind up doing. What is interesting about the current influx of immigrants coming into the city is, one, we're dealing with thousands of new residents a day, which certainly does present a challenge, no matter what city you're in or what you're trying to do. But also, the issue is that in many of the newly arriving immigrants do not already have friends and family in the United States or in the city who are able to connect them to some of those first jobs that people are likely to get. And that does sort of present an initial hurdle. But what we find overwhelmingly is that immigrants are remarkably adept, just like everyone else, at overcoming that initial hurdle and finding that first job. And once that first immigrant in that family has a job, it makes it easier for everyone else in their family to find a job, as well as anyone else who they might know who comes after them. And that's how we're ultimately going to wind up finding a whole new community of immigrants growing right here in New York.
And Anthony, if you can compare that to other parts of the country, I know you did a press conference in Texas and Colorado. where you talked about that. Can you contrast that area and perhaps some other areas with what's happening in New York?
Of course. You know, one of the main differences is that obviously New York is a city that's very accustomed to immigrants. There are lots of immigrants here already. And in general, people do tend to make more working in New York, although, of course, as we all know, the cost of living is much higher. Part of the one of the main differences that we find is that in places like Colorado, where the immigrant populations or the immigrant communities may not be as large, there are then sort of greater needs of new immigrants as they arrive to get settled. But we've also seen many great examples of cities like Boston and Chicago managing the new arrivals very, very effectively. And I think in a lot of ways, it shows us some of the pitfalls that we've had in the city of in terms of just really bad policy decisions that have really made the scenario worse for everyone, whether you are a newly arriving immigrant or you are working in the shelter system or a community organization trying to provide services. But of course, what remains the same is that immigrants continue, no matter where you look in the country, they continue to find good jobs and experience a tremendous amount of upward economic mobility over the course of their lives in the U.S.
And if I could add on, I mean, I feel like one of the things that was really moving, or I don't know, I thought great about that press conference that Anthony did, was hearing the person we were working with in Texas, Jaime Puente, talking about what it was like in Texas. Because, of course, they're facing a lot of the same challenges and doing a lot of the same things and experiencing a lot of the same positive long-term effects as we do in New York and Chicago and Washington. But of course, the political leadership there looks really different. And so when you get below the political leadership and start to talk about who are the people on the ground who are really, you know, addressing the challenges, who are the people who are working with immigrants there, it looks a lot the same as it does here, even though not that we have great examples in the North necessarily of mayors and governors doing as much as they could, but it looks pretty different when you start to look at places like Texas.
And we're speaking with David Disregard-Kallick, director of the Immigration Research Initiative, and his compatriot, Anthony Capote, senior data and policy analyst, of course, with the Immigration Research Initiative. And I'm interested now what you would suggest, or what the report suggests, highlight for us the major conclusions of the report and the research undertaken to come to these conclusions, because around issues of wages and taxes, there were all kinds of things that I thought were extremely important to debunk the mythologies that new immigrants, asylum seekers, do anything other than to contribute, as I said, to the economy and to boost economy, to, excuse me, boost democracy, which, my goodness, are we in the way of needing.
Absolutely. I can speak a little bit, Mimi, about the methodology behind the report. One of the main things that we wanted to do was try and model out what folks' economic outcomes would look like, not only when they first arrived in the U.S., and so we looked at folks who had been here for like 2 years or less, and specifically, you know, we wanted to look at people who were not English proficient or had, you know, sort of limited English proficiency. And then we wanted to look at how immigrants do when they've been in the U.S. longer. So we looked at people who've been here 5 years, 10 years, and then 20 or more years, really to try to get a sense of what does the economic life of an immigrant look like after that initial arrival to the United States. And of course, one of the main things that we found is, not shockingly, people sort of, they grow through the economy, right? Their wages routinely go up the longer they spend in the U.S. And obviously a big factor here is your ability to find legal work authorization, right? As long as we can make that easier for folks, then we know that they're much more likely to get good jobs where they're less likely to be taken advantage of by their bosses or trapped in a scenario where maybe they're afraid to speak up or afraid to stand up for themselves because they don't know what's going to happen to their work status. And of course, we also found, and David did a lot of the research on this, so I'll let him talk about it, but we found that not only do immigrants contribute to the economy, but they also contribute to state and local taxes.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a lot of what both of you have been asking. I mean, I think, Ken, you're asking about the fiscal impacts. For every 1,000 workers, we found that there were, in the very first year, on average for the U.S., about $22 million in overall wages. So that's a gauge of their economic contribution, and $2 million in state and local taxes that help offset the costs of getting people started. And then after 5 years, it's more like $32 million in overall wages and $3 million in state and local taxes. People are, you know, getting jobs, working, paying taxes, using services, just like the rest of us. And I think, I mean, actually, Anthony, I haven't heard you say it before, but I think that idea that people, we have a system that places blame downwards is exactly the problem, right? That that other people who are here and feel like they're in need of services too easily, too often, look to the newest newcomers and say, oh, they shouldn't be getting anything. But, you know, lower income people in America were getting so little to begin with. It's not like having no newcomers is going to be the solution. In fact, I really do think that the solution is for all of us together, including the newcomers, to be able to say we need to do something different so that everybody's taken care of.
Mm-hmm. So let's parse out your findings by race and gender, which you maintain is an even bigger factor in predicting wages than whether somebody is an immigrant.
That's a really great question. We have done a lot of research on this particular issue, looking at the impacts of race, gender, and nativity on individuals' economic outcomes. And what we've found is really stark and I've often found appalling. For example, we know that well over half, 52% of Latina women, so women who have moved to the United States from Latin America, are making less than 2/3 of the median wage in this country. And that's on full-time, year-round work. So that means that most Latinx women who move to the United States and work full-time, that's 35 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, most of them are making, at the national level, less than $35,000 a year. That's not enough to support themselves or their families. That is well below the average cost of living in this country. And what it shows us, first and foremost, is that women, particularly women of color, are the primary victims of a deeply unfair economic system, as well as a deportation regime that actively seeks to punish them for seeking out a better life in this country, where they've been told their entire lives, this is the place to come and build a better life for yourself.
So we're at that point where we want to make sure that people continue to tap into the font of information, the incredible reports that have been put together for an extensive period of time now by the Immigration Research Initiative. And as we draw to a conclusion, and we still have some time left, what do you think the major takeaways are in terms of policy and advocacy for those of us who are listening to push for our policymakers to understand? What kind of legislation, what kind of positioning do we need, given the particularly reactionary policies that are there relevant to the border? Your thoughts on that, both Anthony Capote and David Disregard-Kallick?
Well, okay, I can start. I mean, I feel like We should just have a little confidence that we can do this. I feel like the mayors and governors who are acting as though this is a panic, you know, that we're panicking, that this is something we can't manage, should just take a breath and step back and say, you know, I mean, I lived through September 11th, the Great Recession. We just went through a global pandemic, for God's sake. I mean, this is a challenge, but it's one we can manage, and we should know that in the end, it's good for us. So, I mean, I feel like we can invest enough money to be able to put people up in shelters, or however they, you know, ideally move people out of the shelters now who shouldn't be there to begin with, but should be in supportive long-term housing, and find ways to take care of people when they first come, and just feel confident that when we do that, it's going to return on that investment for us. So I think at the moment, I mean, I don't have a lot of hope that Congress is going to do anything very meaningful right now. But I think that the state and local governments can do a lot.
What can they do? And then Anthony, weigh in when you say they can do a lot. I don't think most people are aware of that. And aside from Texas, which thinks that everything relevant to immigration is a states' rights issue. But where, what, if you had your wish list, and Anthony, then take us out with your wish list and concerns on this most critical issue for any country that at least portends to be democratic and hopes to realize democracy. And that means the least amongst us, and that means our immigrant siblings must have equal rights and justice. And it must be understood that this is a country of immigrants other than indigenous and slave labor who built this country and will continue to.
Well, I mean, one very obvious thing that just seems to me like it's sort of a no-brainer, I can't believe people aren't putting more into it, is legal services to help people get work authorization more quickly, help people through the immigration process as much as they can. That's something that would be, you know, that repays itself in dollars on the nickel. And I think it makes total sense, and there's just not enough of that. So legal services, I think case management to help people to figure out, as we do with other populations, how do we help people to figure out our American systems and how to make their way through them. And I think housing. I think we need to be doing something that at the same time addresses the long-term needs of people who have been here and are unhoused and have not enough affordable housing in their cities, as well as also helping people who are coming in to figure out how they can make their way here. So that'll be top of my list.
It's a good list. Anthony?
Obviously everything's on David's list. I think what is really important is, first and foremost, we need better affordable housing options, both temporary and long-term, for not just immigrants, but all New Yorkers. All Americans, really, everybody needs a way to be able to put a roof over their heads and not spend their life worrying about whether or not, you know, they can buy food that day or pay their rent. I also think, and I, this sort of comes from my personal background, when my parents and grandparents came to this country in the 70s and 80s, and wound up coming well through the 2000s, one of the things that really made life easier for Cuban immigrants was an expedited path toward work authorization and legal residency. That made life so much more manageable for so many people in my community, because it let us know that even though things were difficult when we first arrived, they were going to get better. We knew they were going to get better, and it enabled us, and even better, it empowered us to go out and start businesses and find good jobs and just really support each other and support our families in ways that I've always felt other immigrants were not as privileged to receive. And this is something that, quite frankly, we can start extending to everybody who comes to this country.
And the report that you can find online at the Immigration Research Initiative, and it's chock full of other information. What is that information? Well, in this instance, it's New York by region and also at all 50 states, how newly arrived immigrants, how asylum seekers go on to benefit enormously economically, culturally, and democratically, this country, which was built on slave labor, indigenous labor, and the labor of we who are immigrants. and still more to come. I want to thank David Disregard-Kallick and Anthony Capote for all the great work they do. Keep us posted because we are a nation of immigrants. We must be. And what could be better and what could be stronger towards pushing against white supremacy and all that flows from that? I'm Mimi Rosenberg.
I'm Ken Nash.
And you've been listening to Building Bridges, and that's what we do. Definitely not walls.
Isaiah 2:4 says, "And he shall judge among the nations, and shall rebuke many people. And they shall beat their swords into plowshares, and their spears into pruning hooks. Nations shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore."